Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Maybe this was inevitable. First, the Leave It to Beaver American family portrait gets torn up by divorce. Single moms prove they can do it alone if they have to. Then men and women reassess each other through the lens of women's rights, and genetic science makes artificial everything possible. Now, a growing number of women who want to have babies but don't have husbands are just skipping the men and dialing up the sperm bank. Giving up on romance and relationship and reaching for a catalog of donors. How is this so different, they ask, from single parenthood post-divorce? Up next on Point, mail order motherhood and women having babies by choice without men. Joining me now from New York is Jennifer Egan. She's a writer for the New York Times, and her article on the new trend of single motherhood by choice appears in the coming Sunday Times magazine. Jennifer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What have you found? What's going on?
Well, a growing number of women, although it's hard to say how many because single mothers by choice are not statistically separated from, for example, a teenage girl who gets pregnant and has a child and who's not married. Mm-hmm. But it seems that a growing number of women are choosing to go ahead and have children on their own before their fertility expires, as it were, rather than continue to wait for the proverbial Mr. Right.
So this is before marriage, without a partner, in fact, no relationship with a man necessarily involved at all here.
Exactly. I mean, I think most of these women, probably all of them, would say, look, we would rather have a partner. And many of them have held out a long time and sometimes too long, hoping for that partner. But the cold fact of the matter is that women are not fertile forever. So, in the end, the question for a woman who has not found the right man is, should she also have to forego the dream of having a child? And more women are saying, no, I want to do this, and hopefully I will then find the man. But the traditional order of these events is being reversed in some cases.
It's an amazing picture, a kind of sense of liberation from what you call the traditional order. We'll look at the cultural shift that's behind that. What do we know about the numbers? What gauges are out there?
Well, we know that the number of women who have had children without a partner between the ages of 30 and 44 has risen 17% in the last 5 years. Okay. And as opposed to the number of women between the ages of 15 and 24 who have had children out of wedlock, which has actually decreased by about 6%.
So traditionally, that's what you would expected in that younger age, traditionally. But now it's
exactly
going up in the kind of biological clock fear period.
Exactly. I mean, you have to figure a woman who has a child out of wedlock at 43 is unlikely to have become pregnant by accident. It just, it doesn't happen that easily at that age. So, again, it's hard to know exactly what to take away from those statistics, but it's striking. And also, the largest sperm bank in the country, California Cryobank, owes a third of its business to single mothers. And they have only begun to separate that group out from, for example, lesbian couples who have been purchasing sperm to have children for many years. They've only separated out the single mothers in the last 2 years, but they find that one-third of their very large business is going to these women. So that's also fairly striking.
And a third of what are we talking here with the largest Cryobank? A third of, dozens, hundreds, thousands?
33,000 vials of sperm per year is what they sold in 2005.
Jennifer, you can describe the process. Okay, here's a woman, maybe she's, I don't know what the range of ages is. I don't know how young this urge begins, but how did she go about accomplishing this?
Well, usually, in terms of age, the average age of the membership of Single Mothers by Choice, which is a sort of networking group for women who are interested in this, is 36. Mm. But some women are doing it earlier. Basically, it usually seems to begin with a kind of query, maybe I should think about this if I really, really want to have children. And then often a sort of information gathering period follows. And that's where the Single Mothers by Choice network is very helpful because there are 11 listservs and the women communicate and ask each other questions and share information. The next step is usually to find a reproductive endocrinologist to help with the insemination.
That seems to be leaping ahead. What about the choice of the father, if you will, the long-distance dad?
Well, often the endocrinologist actually does come first because usually there's sort of a fertility workup. I mean, the women are examined and, you know, discuss what exactly needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Most women who choose artificial insemination, and by the way, you know, a fair number of women also adopt, which is a separate process and rather difficult for single women, which is one reason so many are going to sperm donors. But anyway, so the reproductive endocrinologist is necessary for most forms of artificial insemination. So, and also you can't just buy sperm as an individual. You can't just, you know, order sperm to be brought to your home. It's essentially sort of a prescription item. So it actually requires the participation of a physician.
So
and that's another reason.
You've got the prescription then, and how do you, then what?
Well, the sperm is purchased, and usually, I mean, people do that all in varying amounts. Many doctors like to do what they call back-to-back inseminations, which means that in 1 month, a woman would be inseminated on two consecutive days. Because, of course, what the doctor is trying to do is find the exact moment of optimal fertility. So usually, the woman goes in to have blood tests early in her cycle, and the cycle is tracked with a home ovulation kit. And
But before that comes this choice, and you write about it so compellingly. I mean, you describe one woman, Karen, 39 years old, spending night after night, looking at the online dating realm, and then finally saying, forget it, and pulling up instead the website of a sperm bank and choosing not a date but a sperm donor.
Exactly. Well, anyway, so when things are set up with the doctor, then she must choose the sperm. And there are many choices. And women describe feeling very overwhelmed often the first time that they look at these sperm bank sites. And it also involves some hard looking at yourself because you can't, you know, you have to ask yourself, what matters to me? I mean, you're looking at this enormous amount of data, race, gender, you know, and also family health history, things you might not know about someone you had been dating for months. And so anyway, they have to start making some choices. And usually that is sometimes it's a fairly instantaneous process, as it was in the woman you mentioned, Karen, who essentially describes a kind of love at first sight.
She saw a photograph of a sperm donor and that was it, basically.
Basically, yes. Now, that is actually, it's unusual in that not many banks offer adult photographs of donors. As you can imagine, many donors are anxious about having contemporary photographs of themselves posted. So that is the minority. For some women, it's a much more sort of deductive process. They look at a lot, they narrow it down, they go back and forth. There's also an issue of availability. I've heard many tales of women picking a donor and then finding that he's not available. His sperm is still in quarantine, which all sperm must be for 6 months, to, which is the maximum incubation period for HIV, to make sure that there's no disease there.
But the shopping process, the shopping mentality in your conversations, and you had a lot of them here and you've written it up wonderfully, what is it that women, how are they assessing their options when it comes to, you know, not dating, but choosing a sperm donor?
Well, I think that they, you know, it's interesting. It seems like a combination of analysis and impulse. In the case of Karen, the impulse was foremost. She saw him and said, bam, he's the one. But for a lot of people, there's some analysis and scrutiny followed by a sense that, yes, this is the one. It's usually a thing that the donor said or wrote, because some banks offer audio tapes of donors. There's usually some little piece of information or statement from the donor that creates a feeling of connection.
Like what? Like a hair color, eye color, a twinkle they see in a photograph, a favorite piece of poetry? I don't know.
Well, I feel like I've probably heard every one of those things. But for example, one woman, often much more common than adult photos are baby photos. A lot of sites post those of donors, and people will feel that they sort of recognize that it looks like someone in their own family or someone that they cared about. Often it would be something that the donor said or books that he liked. Some little piece of information about him or comment from him that makes them feel that he's special or has a connection to them.
Jennifer, we're going to hear in this hour from women who have made this choice, but what's your big assessment of what's going on here culturally that women now feel free, feel empowered to sort of dial up the donor and go for it without a man?
Well, I think that they also are just feeling more realistic. I think that there's a sense, I think there was a period there where people believed that, you know, wow, there are all these great new fertility drugs. We can keep having children until we're 50. But what I think now there's been a bit of a correction there, and women are coming to understand that if you want to use donor eggs, yes, you can probably get pregnant until you're 50. But if you really want to use your own eggs, you have a much more limited window than was formerly believed. And so I think there is something liberating about the possibility of saying, I don't have to give up everything just because I haven't found the right man by the time I'm 40. I mean, you know, men don't have to worry about this. They can say, gee, I haven't found the right woman. I guess I'll be waiting till I'm 50 to have kids. We can't do that if we want them to be our biological children. So I think there is something liberating about it, yes.
I'm joined in the studio right now by a woman who has made exactly this choice. Shelby Sims is with me. She's a single mother by choice. She has a 2-year-old son by artificial insemination and is just about to give birth, and handsomely so, Shelby, to a second child by the same donor. Shelby Sims, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Here you are in the fullness of pregnancy, and it's not from a husband or from a father that you hang out with. How'd you make this choice?
Well, I wanted to go the traditional route. I looked for Mr. Right until I was 41 years old.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I had a boyfriend, and we were on the verge of breaking up, which we did. I was very aware of my biological clock running out.
At 41, you would be.
Yeah, that's pretty late to wait. As you said, the single mothers by choice average age is 36.
Mm-hmm.
So to be 41 is waiting a long time. After we broke up, I found a reproductive endocrinologist in Boston, and I went for a consultation, and that started the process.
It seems, by one light, as an extreme measure. I mean, what about adoption? What about alternatives? Did you think about that? Or was the you having a biological connection to the child, even if the father's connection would be very distant, was that more important?
Well, I thought a little bit about adoption. If this had not worked, I certainly would have gone in that direction, and I think that's very common among my single mothers by choice fellow members. However, there are many women, of course, who just go straight to adoption. I always wanted to have my own children. I fully expected to get married to Mr.
Mm-hmm,
Wright and
mm-hmm.
have my own children within the confines of marriage. As Jennifer pointed out, it looked like I had lost on Part A, and I didn't want to lose on Part B.
So how's it going? I mean, here you are. You've got a 2-year-old son and another baby very much on the way, and we wish you good luck with
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Do you feel a social stigma? I mean, at one time, you know, a single mother, I mean, it's getting to be some years ago now, but there was a large social stigma. What about this path you've chosen? How do people respond when they hear your story?
Well, it's improving. I think that this is still considered unconventional. My son attends a daycare where he's the only product of a single mother in his class. I was amazed to actually find another mother in the center who is doing exactly what I'm doing, and she's pregnant with her second child at age 45. And this blew me away because I thought in this traditional family town that I had moved to last year, I wouldn't find that, although I do know another woman in town who is a single mother by choice.
So it's amazing. That means you've got a certain density there. What do you plan, Shelby, to tell your children when they're older about their father, their fatherhood?
Mm-hmm. Well, I plan to be very open about it. This issue has come up somewhat already. Around the time of his second birth, he started asking for his daddy. He sees
second
daddies.
Second birthday, this is of your 2-year-old
son. Of my
son.
2-year-old, mm-hmm. Yep. He sees daddies at daycare. He sees daddies all over the place. And he, one night, he had been asking, I want my daddy, I want my daddy. One night, he had an all-out temper tantrum. Nothing was going to appease my son except for daddy. And
Wow.
I really didn't want this to happen so soon. Yeah. He's a precocious little boy.
2 years old, though, and articulating that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I want my daddy.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to deal with this. I had two problems on my hand. It was getting very late at night. He was not wanting to go to bed. He was acting out, and he was asking for his daddy. And I, I did not want to have a conversation with him about his daddy at that time, as my blood pressure was rising because of the temper tantrum. But in any case, I had to put an end to this somehow so we could get some sleep. I did...
That's easy. That's one night. There's a whole lifetime here.
Sure.
How do you intend to eventually convey this, and how do you think that's going to play
out? That night I sort of blurted out, "Do you see a daddy here? There is no daddy here.
Wow.
I am your mommy, and I am here, and I'm taking care of you." Mm-hmm. I blurted that out of frustration. Mm. Now, the next day, we were having lunch together in the kitchen, and he mentioned his daddy, mm-hmm. and of course, we were in a much better mood. It was a new day, and I said to him, "Christopher, your family is made up of mommy, you, and Sparkplug, our dog." And so that was a way of addressing it. And that's the last we've had a conversation about it. He seemed satisfied with what he heard. I didn't want to put a negativity onto the conversation. I didn't want to say, "You don't have a daddy." I don't want to say what he doesn't have, because actually he also doesn't have grandparents. He also doesn't have aunts and uncles, and he also doesn't have first cousins.
This is a new world. You have used the same donor twice, and we'll talk about that. Shelby Sims, how many months pregnant now, Shelby?
I'm due in 3 weeks.
We wish you well with
that.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Carmen's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Carmen. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think, Carmen?
Well, I was a little bit troubled by the way that the question is posed, namely that women are forgoing love and marriage. They are forgoing marriage. I really don't think that they're forgoing love. I think that's always an open possibility.
Well, we said they're forgoing husbands and flesh and blood fathers. Love, I don't know. How do you see what's going on?
Well, I do believe that, if I may, that was one of the reasons I called, because said love and marriage.
Okay.
And I think that speaks to, first of all, the cultural paradigm that is so strong. And the fact is that making this choice is just reorganizing priorities. It doesn't mean they're precluding or excluding love. It just means that love with another man is not at this moment important. Even as you spoke, you were speaking about flesh and blood fathers. Obviously, these children have flesh and blood fathers. They're just unknown to them.
Unknown, not reachable, not huggable. But what about that? The absence of love for a partner or a partner at all. Is that all right? Is that okay? How do you look at that, Carmen?
Well, I believe it's perfectly all right. Certainly, historically, when you talk about women who, for any number of reasons, war widows, etc., were faced with raising children alone,
mm-hmm.
that was never questioned, and yet their ability to raise these children successfully was accepted, and in fact, many people feel proven with the results.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we've got a lot of single parents today. Raising kids, there's no question about that. Carmen, thanks for your call. Jennifer Egan, what about it? How do you see people responding to this trend? People who aren't involved in it, like Shelby Sims, but looking on, how do they tend to take it on board?
Well, in my world, which is the world of urban, working, fairly well-educated women, it is becoming a slightly known thing. So I don't detect a lot of judgments there. I'm curious, too. I mean, of course, there's the classic argument, which I'm sure is much discussed on the Single Mothers by Choice listservs, is the question of, you know, whether this is somehow a selfish thing to do to a child. And obviously, it's a tricky question. But I mean, from my point of view, if you think about how many children are born into families where they are not wanted and where they cannot be supported, I just feel like if you want to focus on problems that children have to face, that is a much, much bigger one. I mean, these are women who want children and feel the potential to love them so much that they are willing to do this completely on their own, take full financial responsibility. And I think one has to trust that they have given this a fair amount of thought. They've had to go to a huge amount of effort and often a huge amount of expense to do it. And one of the things that's discussed a lot among these women, and Shelby can speak to this too, is the question of how to give these children what they need. How to give, for example, boy children male role models. How to deal with the question of disclosing to them their background. Mm-hmm. I interviewed a 9-year-old girl who is the daughter of a single mother by choice, a mom who's still single. And she was incredibly eloquent on the subject. I mean, she was giggling, saying that, you know, she has to explain what sperm and eggs are to her peers, but, you know, that she's proud of the fact that her mom has been a great mom, and she loves understanding all this and explaining it to her peers. So I have to say, I did not detect a lot of sorrow there.
Jennifer Egan, Shelby Sims, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Brooklyn in New York, Dr. Kathleen Gerson, professor of sociology at New York University, author of the forthcoming Children of the Gender Revolution. Dr. Gerson, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. I've been enjoying the conversation.
So there are just a million questions pressing here. Maybe it's because I'm a guy. I don't know. But how do you see, Dr. Gerson, the change in the culture that makes an awful lot of people look at this and say, fine?
Absolutely. In fact, virtually everything that has been said is something that I not only agree with, but I have found in my research on shifts in the gender relationships and ideals and choices of this new generation. And I guess I would divide this into two pieces. First, what are the causes of these shifts? And secondly, what are the consequences?
Okay.
So let's talk about the causes. It shouldn't surprise us if we think about this more deeply that everything that's being described here is really one piece of a much larger puzzle of changes in the lives of women, especially, but men as well. The first part of that puzzle is that women have become economically independent.
Mm-hmm.
The rise of women as workers has given them, if not equality at work, economic independence, economic individualism, if you will.
Mm.
And that has opened up choices that they never had before. It's changed the nature of relationships with men and our decisions about childbearing and child rearing. It's not that women or men are rejecting marriage, far from it, but marriage is no longer an economic bargain. In fact, the stakes are much higher. And you mentioned what women are not looking for old-fashioned dads, but they're looking for new-fashioned dads.
But in this case, the dad is not even there. It's just
it's a
vial of sperm.
But I think the point that has been made is that women who decide to have children on their own are saying, first of all, many women have children, and then their fathers are not there in
mm-hmm.
any case.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not foreclosing the possibility of finding a lifelong romantic attachment, nor an involved parent of the male persuasion for their children. But what they're saying is, I'm not going to settle. I have very high standards for the kind of relationships that I want in my life, for myself and for my child. And I can, and so there is an increasing separation, if you will, between romantic decisions and parenting decisions.
Your new book is called Children of the Gender Revolution. What about the children? I'm thinking of Shelley
mm-hmm.
Sims.
Right.
Shelby Sims' son, and I'm sure
exactly.
that was a difficult night, standing in the kitchen, and your two-year-old is saying, where
Absolutely.
Is my daddy?
And that gets us to the consequences part of this shift. What are the consequences? And I think the important thing to say here is that we are in very dangerous waters if we try to overgeneralize. What we know is that children thrive in a variety of circumstances, but that most important is that they have the love and support of the people who take care of them. Many children ask where their parents are. I think the point was made, not only that widows have raised children alone for centuries, and in fact 100 or so years ago, children were more likely to grow up in one-parent homes mm. because people died or deserted, but also that in a world where marriage itself is fluid, where partnerships change, many children are living in what we have come to call non-traditional family forms. And there is no simple, easy, even if you are in a two-parent home, children are going to ask tough questions that you have to answer.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I think quickly my answer to that mm-hmm. is the most important thing any parent can do for a child is to, first of all, make sure that they are taking care of themselves and that they are happy so they can take care of their children. And secondly, that they are nurturing and loving and honest toward their children. And what the research shows about single mothers, whether they are single mothers by choice or single mothers by circumstance, is that they go about the process that we have forgotten about in this society of creating a larger network of kin, fictive kin, people who become, who get pulled into the family, and also, and networks of support, both within their family and without their family, so that these children are not growing up isolated.
Dr. Gerson, stand by for a moment, if you would.
Sure.
I want to bring one more voice in here, and Jennifer Egan, I wish you'd introduce her. A woman you've written about, Daniela, is joining us from Atlanta. She's traveling there on business. We'll hear from her in just a moment. Jennifer Egan, who's Daniela? What's her story?
Daniela is a 38-year-old woman who is in the process of trying to conceive, and she is single.
All right. Daniela, hi. Thanks for joining us from Atlanta.
Thank you.
You're trying to become a single mother. I mean, you're on this path. You're looking, or you're already engaged with sperm donors and choosing sperm donors. And why are you on this path?
Well, you kind of said single mothers by choice, and I tend to not agree with that. Most people that I know that are going through that, it's actually a single mother by not choice, because most of my relationships always had the issue about children. And we don't have the possibility to just say, well, yes, we get to know one another for 3 years and then we look into having, you know, children. I was actually married and I separated from my husband because he chose not to have children anymore. And then again, when I was later on in my life engaged, the problem that I wanted, or not the problem, but the desire of me having children was a problem in our relationship. So that dissolved again. So I didn't really have the choice of doing it with a partner.
And you've just gone through the process. In a week or two, you'll know if you're pregnant.
Yeah.
Your fingers are crossed. And what are you hoping for? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I've been going through this process now several times. This is like the sixth time that I've done this. And the chances are not very high when you're doing this. So it is a very frustrating and emotional process. I'm definitely hoping that I'm pregnant, but you never know, because I'm still doing it the very natural way. I don't have any fertility drugs or anything like that. So for me, it was just going through the process of finding the right doctor, finding, you know, the sperm donor that you're looking for. And I did not look for pictures. I didn't look at pictures or winks or recordings or writings or anything like that, because if I cannot offer my child that father that I always wanted to, then I didn't really want to know too much about him either. I just wanted to make sure it's a healthy, you know, kind of a multicultural donor that, you know, would provide me with a good child.
The person out of the picture, the genetic package in the picture. Daniela, we wish you luck.
Thank you.
In everything. Thanks for joining us from Atlanta. David's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I see a real problem here, Tom, and that is that when we participate in this kind of conduct, and I mean we as a species, we're basically running away from our humanity. And when we do this enough, we end up creating huge problems for ourselves, which we never envisioned. And technology alone can give you many examples. But I find your guests to be, you know, and I hate to put it this way, but disingenuous. I think they're failing to be honest with themselves and with the people around them. And they're using romantic ideals, the failure of romantic ideals, to excuse their failure to engage in human contact with another person to do the most fundamental thing in life, and that's create new life. Animals don't do this in the wild, and we are nothing but sophisticated animals. You know, we have all kinds of other stuff going on, but we're just really complicated animals that talk.
Really complicated, that's for sure. David, let us pick that up. Kathleen Gerson, first to you. David says this is running away from humanity, and the suggestion is humanity will pay for it somehow.
Well, it's certainly a very compelling argument, and I think we do need to think about it very, very carefully. I do take great disagreement with the notion that this is disingenuous. I don't think that women who are choosing to have children in this way are running away from relationships. They are looking for mutually supportive and positive relationships. Those may be harder to come by in a world in which we are reinventing relationships as we speak. The old template of relationships, which was one in which there was a bargain between a male breadwinner and a female caretaker, has broken down. I think we are in the process of recreating human relationships. The potential is there to have the most romantic, egalitarian, satisfying human connections possible. Never before in human history has it been possible to create families that were based on these purely emotional attachments. That's the good news. But I also agree that it's we can't mandate this. This is the future is uncertain, and we can't force people into these relationships. And I think we have to accept the fact that being human means being a member of a very diverse species. This was Darwin's primary understanding of the process of natural selection, that we are a diverse group, and so, not all of us are going to want the same kinds of human relationships.
So here's another facet on the diamond, and it can feel extraordinarily new, yet you point out in some ways it's old, single parenting. Shelby Sims, you hear David's earnestness. I mean, he looks at this, and it's just absolutely unsettling to him, and I can imagine that as a common response. This is running away from humanity, he says. How do you respond?
Well, I have to disagree with him. I can see how it looks very strange and unsettling from the outside, and sure enough, I would have to admit the first time I ever heard of a sperm bank, which probably happened many years ago watching the news, I was a little bit horrified myself. Well, here I am, and I've become a big proponent of it. I don't agree with that. I actually have a boyfriend right now. I have never run away from relationships. I, like Daniela, have been with men who did not want to have children. In fact, my current boyfriend does not want to get married or have children or live with me and my family. So it is still not what I'm looking for. I have always been very clear about wanting to get married if it was the right person. I don't want to settle for someone who I don't feel is the right person. But I have always been trying to connect with men. I worked on it until I was 41 years of age.
And the clock was running out, and you made a
decision. The clock was running out, and I could have waited. It could have been too late for me. It very easily could have been too late for me. I was very, very lucky to be able to get pregnant at that point.
Jennifer Egan, you quote one woman saying, "I'm taking charge of this piece of it. I'm not going to wait around for a guy to give it to me." In fact, sort of women changing their very sense of what they want and need from men, maybe not fathering.
Well, I think that once you separate, once you decide, you say, I can actually have the children on my own without the man, which, as I think has been said many times, does not mean giving up the hope or the dream of having a partner. Mm-hmm. But once those two things are separated, yes, it is somewhat empowering for the woman. I mean, you have to think about what it feels like to want children desperately and on every single date be hoping, okay, maybe this is the one. And meanwhile, looking at that calendar and knowing you're getting older, it is a huge relief to be released from that pain and that sense of powerlessness.
But you describe, we talked to Daniela earlier, we had to let her go, she was traveling on business, but you described Daniela, who's working very hard on this, we heard how many times she's attempted it, but this situation where she's with the boyfriend, they're actually having sex protected, and at the same time, she's in the midst of trying to become pregnant by artificial insemination.
That actually wasn't Daniela, that was another subject
in
the story.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay, but yes,
I'm pointing at. I mean, there's the man, but it's the vial of stuff that's got priority.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems very strange in one way, but when you think about it, it is a lot less. It is a careful strategy as opposed to what would be a somewhat more reckless strategy of just sleeping with the guy, hoping to get pregnant, having no idea what kind of entanglements would result for her and for her child. So it's actually a rather prudent way to proceed, I think with a long view in mind rather than a short-term goal.
Wow, prudence in a whole new light. Steve's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
We're good. What do you think, Steve?
I actually want to commend these women for her actually, you know, having enough guts to stand up and say, I want a child. If no man wants to help me have my child, I have enough support in myself where I can stand on my own two feet and raise a child healthily and not worry about, you know, a guy who doesn't want to be pregnant, like you said, with that lady who's having protected sex with a partner but is going through the process.
And you don't feel sidelined, Steve, as a man? You don't feel put out to pasture here?
No, I really don't. I mean, a lot of guys these days don't want to have children. I mean, just because guys don't want to doesn't mean women should have to give up that right also because the guy does not want to have a child. I mean, these women it's a right to have children. It's an honor to have children. If they want to have children, who are we to say the way you're having them is wrong?
Steve, I'm sure they're going to be nodding right along with you, and we thank you for your call. Let me get another one. Tova's calling from Boston. Hi, Tova. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, good. What do you think, Tova?
Well, I'm a pioneer. I had a child by myself using a sperm bank 16 years ago.
Very early on.
Very early on.
Were you married? Had you given up on marriage? How did you choose?
I was unmarried. I had been looking for somebody for many years. I was 35 years old, and it was time to start my family.
How's it worked out?
Wonderfully.
Son or daughter?
I have a son. He's a terrific kid. He's well-adjusted. He's happy. He does well in school.
Did he say to you, "Where's my daddy?" Does he still? What's that relationship?
No, it's interesting. I think with these kids, it depends on how you present it to them and your approach toward them. But it was always very clear to him from the very beginning that he was special. And I gave him the information as he was able to handle it at various ages. And he has absolutely no interest in knowing who the donor was or has no interest in, you know, in having a father. He's happy.
So you're very experienced. What do you say to other women who might be considering this? How do you urge them to think about it?
You have to think of the financial implications because you have to work and you have to support a kid and you basically have to do both roles. And you have to be prepared for things that come up like, you know, Father's Day activities at school where
yep.
fathers are expected to participate and so on. And just be prepared for all the implications of what you've done. And you have to work very, very hard.
I can hear that. There's the voice of experience. Tova, thank you for calling. Let me get another call from Sharon in Boston. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's very interesting this has happened upon me. This has really been in the news quite a bit because I found out 2 weeks ago that I'm a donor-conceived child. I'm 30 years old, and
Two weeks ago, this is the brand new news. How are you taking it on board?
Brand new, and my head's not in the right place yet. I've been a mess and trying to figure it out and what to do with my thoughts. And I right away jumped online, as everybody does, and I quickly found the Donor Sibling Registry, which is at DonorSiblingRegistry.com. It's a fantastic website started by a woman who actually used a donor to conceive her son.
Sharon, we're going to hear from exactly that woman in just a minute.
Yes.
But tell us, did you have a father that you knew or you thought was your father?
Yes, you know, my father that quote raised me. He was a difficult father to live with, but he was unable to conceive. So he and my mother had my brother, well, me first, and then my brother. We assumed by the same donor through the registry. I've posted my information hoping to find some half-siblings or hoping to find my donor. I'm also searching diligently every day to find my donor father because we think we know at least the vicinity he may be in. And it's a very interesting position to find yourself in. There are a couple of Yahoo groups out there of donor-conceived children who are, you know, sharing their emotions and making connections. And then there's also the Donor Sibling Registry Yahoo group where everyone who's involved in this field can kind of connect and share emotions and feelings because the kids who have been conceived in my generation, you know, 30, 40, maybe even 20 years ago, they rarely had any information about the donors. I don't have any idea about this guy's medical history. I don't know what I'm at risk for.
Yep. Sharon, we hear it, and I wish you'd stand by because we've got the founder of the Donor Sibling Registry with us, and in your story we can kind of hear the sound of a new community being born. We're joined from Boulder, Colorado right now by Wendy Kramer. She founded the Donor Sibling Registry. Wendy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Why did you found the registry? What's the purpose?
Well, good question. Because of my own son's curiosity. And I think, you know, what I hear today is, you know, I hear the needs and the desires of women, you know, wanting to be mothers. And I honor that and I respect that. But I think at the same time, we need to take into consideration the innate curiosity that these kids may have about their genetic history and origins and think about how they're going to address that as far as picking anonymous donors. donors or known donors. And
so you help connect siblings, people who are siblings via sperm donors across the country? You put them together somehow?
Exactly. My own son he's a sperm donor child and has known also since he was two, and he asked me. And he's always had the curiosity about his genetic origins, you know, his donor father and any siblings that he may have. So out of that curiosity, because there was no other vehicle, my son and I started the donor sibling registry just as a little message on a Yahoo group, which then, you know, has grown into thousands of members, and we've connected over 1,600 people, and that's half siblings to half siblings and donors to offspring.
And what's your suggestion to Sharon, who's just learned 2 weeks ago that this is her origin, trying to take it on board? What do you say to her, Wendy?
You know, this is not the first time that I've heard stories like this. The thing that I could say that would mean the most would be to parents who have donor kids to please disclose, please be honest. I've heard too many stories of adults finding out, or older kids finding out, that they were donor conceived, and they feel this great sense of betrayal. And I think that we owe it to our kids to be honest with them and to honor their curiosity. So these moms who are having these kids, even though the moms may not have the curiosity, they need to honor that in the kids if they hear that as the kids, you know, grow up and come to the donor sibling registry and, you know, see if they can make those connections. And it's not important for all kids. Like the one mom said, you know, her 17-year-old son is, you know, doesn't really have any interest. But
we can imagine it for an awful lot of them. Our time is so short. Wendy Kramer at the Donor Sibling Registry in Boulder, Colorado, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sharon, we're glad you found it. Jennifer Egan, let me ask you, what about the donors standing behind all this? I mean, do we have... Are there lots and lots, or are there just a few, or do we have men with scores, hundreds of children around the country now?
Well, that is not known for sure, although I think that a better idea is coming from the donor sibling registry, you know, as people begin to connect. I mean, one woman that I interviewed had, who was actually very concerned about, in a similar situation to Shelby, without a lot of family of her own, logged in to find that her little 2-year-old girl has 20 siblings already,
all
ages 3 and under. And this donor is still actively, you know, with the bank. So in a case like that, and you have to assume there are many, there is a potential for a lot of kids. So that's a factor. I mean, that's really an issue for sperm banks, and which are not very heavily regulated by law, as I understand it.
That's a lot of passing on of traits. We hope the good traits.
Yeah, exactly.
Kathleen Gerson, our time is really running down here. Let me just ask you, you know, there are so many kids in this world that need homes. What do you think about our fixation, and men have it too, on biological offspring?
I was just going to point that out with this discussion, because we think we really need to think about the differences between biological and social fatherhood. The person who just called actually had a social father, and then only recently learned that her social father was not her genetic father. And I think it's a sort of irony of the 21st century that on the one hand we have more choices to live in, so many more alternative arrangements, and yet we are increasingly concerned, one might say obsessed, about our genetic heritage. It's really two sides of the same coin. And my response would be exactly what you've heard, which is throughout human history, biological fatherhood has always been problematic. Because while we all often usually, at least until recently, always knew who the biological mother was, the biological father was not so clear-cut. Today we have the capacity to know that, and yet we're also more likely to be living in situations where that is not the social father. And I think the answer is we can't turn back the clock, we can't go back again, we must face this and take responsibility for it, and that is to give children all the information they need about their biological and their social fathers.
Wherever their origins, now living in a whole new way. Dr. Kathleen Gerson at New York University, author of the forthcoming Children of the Gender Revolution. Dr. Gerson, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Shelby Sims, how's the pregnancy going?
Going very well.
We
a little more heartburn than I'd like.
we wish you luck. Thank you so much for being with us. And Jennifer Egan, terrific story, terrific reporting. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.